Welcome to the Raisana podcast from the Observer Research Foundation. Is the Indo-Pacific an organic expression of connectivity, a community of nations, or a strategic construct? The answers to these questions will define national security postures in the region over the next decade. This episode responds to the big questions about the Indo-Pacific. Who defines it? Who will bear the costs of the strategic orientation? What purpose does it serve? And how will it be managed?
Welcome to this evening's panel. My name is Yalda Hakim, and I will be your moderator for the next hour or so, and I hope we have a very dynamic conversation here this evening. I'd like to begin by just making an opening statement. I mean, if the return of great power rivalry is the central challenge of our time, then it's the oceans of the Indo-Pacific that are the central front of this evolving struggle. It's a struggle that has many dimensions, including the economic, ideological, and technological. But critical is the military balance of power, and that really is the subject of this panel. And with us are military leaders from across the region and the world. Please welcome on the stage Admiral Karambir Singh. He's the Chief of Naval Staff for India. General Koji Yamazaki, he's the Chief of Staff, Joint Staff of the Japanese Self-Defense Forces. Vice Admiral David Johnson, Vice Chief of the Defense Force for Australia. General Luc de Rancourt, Deputy Director General for International Relations and Strategy for France, and Admiral Tony Radican, he's the Chief of Naval Staff for the United Kingdom. Admiral Singh, I'd like to begin by asking for your response to this statement. I mean, the number one, two, and three concerns of this region is China, China, and China. Can I get you to respond to that?
You're right. China has, especially the Navy, which is the PLA Navy, is a strategic arm of the PLA. It has grown at a very rapid pace. And we are all aware of the numbers, the tonnage, and the number of ships and everything that is growing. And we have seen in the Indian Ocean region itself, starting 2008, when they came in for the anti-piracy patrol. Before that, they weren't really very obvious in the Indian Ocean region. But now you find at any given time about 7 to 8 PLA Navy ships, warships in the area. You have research vessels, you have int gathering vessels, you have fishing fleet, very large fishing fleet. You already have Djibouti is a reality, Gwadar is on, and there are, I'm sure, more places to come. Also, the if you see the defense exports, nearly 85% of the defense exports are in the Indian Ocean region. So we are really watching and observing what is happening. We have placed our ships in mission-based deployments so that we get an idea of what are the activities, not only China, but any all other countries, all other nations are doing. So that if there's anything that impinges on our national interests or sovereignty, we will have to act. To my mind, I think if there's any maritime activity that deviates from the norm or rule-based order, that can cause regional instability. That's what we are looking for.
Has there been any example of that?
There have been instances when we have had the PLA ships coming into our exclusive economic zone, and wherein we have had to tell them that because we have issued certain addendums to the convention, or we have had to tell them that this impinges on our issue. And if you see the BRI, the CPEC, it impinges on our sovereignty.
Have they respected that? Have they backed off?
Not yet.
So what are you doing about it then? I mean, is there something that's being done other than observing and watching?
So I've told you, we've deployed there. And for example, this particular incident of the exclusive economic zone, we've acted, and then they have respected our request and moved out.
Vice Admiral Johnson, just listening there to Admiral Singh, I mean, you'd have to then admit that the Quad was really formed to counter China.
I don't think I would admit that if you gave me the opportunity to reframe it. Of course, we would describe the Quad is a relationship between democracies who have shared interests. And it is about being able to pursue the interests of the four nations that are characterised as the Quad. It isn't reflective of anti-anything in particular, but it's a valuable mechanism. We have bilateral mechanisms, we have multilateral mechanisms. The Quad is another one of those mechanisms with countries that share objectives and look to find ways to cooperate on them.
That's the official line. But behind closed doors, surely you talk about the concerns that you have of a growing China that's impeaching and perhaps, you know, As Admiral Singh said, they are breaching some of those norms and there's certain activity in the Indo-Pacific.
Yelda, it is that line, but not just the official line. But the Quads, because of the nature of it, it has broad-ranging discussion. That is true around any areas of which one of the four countries believes are of interest to the other partners within that relationship. They are broad-ranging. Our foreign ministers met during the course of last year. So the scope that Quad has to be able to pick a range of themes that are of interest collectively to the four parties is broad.
The foreign ministers you pointed out met. Politically they're meeting. Has that translated then militarily, other than sort of exercises? Is there, because we had this conversation 12 months ago about the Quad and its role. What's changed in the last 12 months, if anything?
The meeting of the foreign ministers was important. Our officials between the Quad nations have met. Remembering, it is a dialogue. So there are whether the manifestations of it occur, I think you're saying, in a military exercise format or others. Our nations do work together in multiple ways militarily, both on real-world operations as well as training exercises. The Quad is just one of the characterizations by which that would occur, but is not the only one. So it is the dialogue that is the most important part, the meeting of minds around key issues, the look at all levers of our collective national power that we can apply to them. That's the value you get from bringing the countries together.
Can I ask you, General Yamazaki, are you worried about war with China?
日本においてはですね、まあ、中国と、まあ、面している、まあ、国であります。
As you have already known that Japan is facing directly to China.
よって我が国の安全保障、また地域の安全保障、世界の平和と安定のために中国の動向について注視をしております。
For the peace and stability, not only the region but the entire world, we are closely watching the situation in China.
非常に軍事力は増強しておりますし、またその、東シナ海、南シナ海、また太平洋地域への海洋の進出については著しいものがあるというふうに思っております。
As you have already known that their military expansion is unprecedented, and then also we can see their maritime expansion in South and the East China Sea.
The US, who's not on this panel, we hear often from them that allies need to step up. And Japan has done that in terms of its defense budget. It's gone up. But how much are they actually doing in terms of risk and cost? It's the defense budget's gone up, but what are they actually doing to put that in place?
この地域の平和と安定のために、まあ、日米同盟があり、まあ、それぞれ、まあ、防衛予算を講じており、我が国においてはこの厳しい安全保障環境においてしっかりと平和と安定を保つための予算が確保されるべきだというふうに思っております。
Japan and US alliance absolutely exist to ensure the peace and stability of this region.Therefore, these budget increase absolutely in order to guarantee the peace and stability in this region under these increasingly severe security circumstances and situation.
しっかりと中国のまた周辺諸国の動向をしっかりと見定めた上においてそれに対応する防衛力の構築というものが今我々に求められていると思います、まあ、その結果として防衛費が増額されているというふうにいうようなことであります。
seeing the detailed situation in regards to China, and including in accordance with the specific situation and circumstances of the neighboring country, that we actually are building the defense force to deal with that circumstances. That is the reason why we actually increase the defense budget.
Do you feel with the US saying, look, allies need to step up, that perhaps you can no longer rely on the United States the way that you once did?
やはりこう地域の平和と安定のために日同盟が果たした役割はこれまで大きいものがありますし、やはり将来にわたってこの地域が平和であるためには日米同盟はなくてはならないというふうに思ってますし、さらにその日米の共同訓練、またそのこのスタッフトークスをはじめ、縮小演習、共同訓練、いろいろな場において日米同盟を強くする場があるわけでありますけれども、すべての面においてロバストの関係を作っていきたいと思っています。
The Japan-US alliance is actually take an important role to guarantee the peace and stability of this region so far for many years. And as well as toward the future, it is the alliance is indispensable to guarantee them. Therefore, we are time to time constantly having the Japan-US bilateral training and exercise, including the staff talks, command post exercise, field training exercise to strengthen those capacity and capability to assure that.
またその領域においても一昨年度貿易額の大綱を策定をいたしましたけれども、陸海空の領域に加えて宇宙、サイバー、電磁波、新領域においてもこれからの戦闘を決するという領域であります。その多次元においてもその日米の役割分担というのをしっかりと議論していきながら日米同盟強化を図ることも重要だと思っています。
As for the coming years, it is integrated in our national defense program guideline that from now on Japan not only the ground, maritime, air domain but also the outer space, cyber, and also electronic magnetic spectrum domain that we will enhance our capability to build our multi-domain defense force that is ensure the, our capability to guarantee that peace and stability of the region.
General Rancor, we heard there from Admiral Singh talk about the Djibouti reality. I mean, France has been in Djibouti the longest. How concerned and worried are you about Chinese presence there?
To begin with, let me say that I'm very honored to be here on that panel today, especially since that's my first time in India. So needless to see that I'm a little impressed. For the presence of China in Djibouti, as we all know, China is more and more assertive, and we see its action being more and more present worldwide, and especially in Africa. For us, we have an Indo-Pacific strategy, which has been presented by our Armed Forces Minister, Florence Parly, last year in the Shangri-La Dialogue in June. And you have to have in mind that Indo-Pacific strategy is not designed against any rival, and has not been designed against China. For that Indo-Pacific strategy, we have several priorities. The first one is to make sure that we protect the sovereignty of our territories, their population. The second one is that we foster the security of the Indo-Pacific region, which to our mind bracket together countries and oceans from the eastern coast of Africa to the west coast of America. And by promoting the stability of that region, we have some security and military cooperation in that area. And it means that we have presence forces in Djibouti as well as in the Gulf. And our presence in Djibouti, which is a very ancient one, is more a way of being able to assess the situation in that part of the world. And of course, we see China arriving, but we have no action against China. The thing which is puzzling us is the fact that we are very attached to the respect of the international law, and we are against any fait accompli that China could intend, especially in the South China Sea.
Are you concerned that China could push you out of Djibouti?
No, because we have sovereign, this is a discussion between sovereign countries with Djibouti and the French, with the Djiboutian government and the French government. And therefore, as we have a very historical relationship with the Djiboutian government, as we are promoting, we are securing their airspace. We are also, we have a defense agreement with them. That's not a problem for us.
Admiral Radican, can you tell us a little bit about Britain's role? Because Britain in a post-Brexit world is describing itself as a more global Britain. What sort of role does it see for itself in the Indo-Pacific?
Thank you. Thank you. So I also am delighted to be here. I think you're right that we're now approaching these international issues from potentially a very different position, with a stable government with a substantial majority and with the clarity about our leaving the EU that we would acknowledge has not existed over the last few years. And I think that is particularly significant both for this region and for the Indo-Pacific, because I think what it does allow the UK government to do is to think much more broadly and potentially more ambitiously about our role in the world, and to acknowledge that we have a substantial role to play, partly as a member of the Security Council, but also as a large world economy and our shared values and interests, which are mirrored with the other members of this panel. And if I turn to this particular region, then I think we would be looking to build on our existing footprint. So that starts with the British Indian Ocean Territory and Diego Garcia in the middle of the Indian Ocean, which is a strategic asset which we would wish to use on behalf of the whole region to promote security and stability. If I then go up to the Northwest and the Gulf, we have a substantial presence in the Gulf. We've established a new permanent base in Bahrain. We now have 8 ships in the Gulf, and over the last year, that's been the norm. So at times, we've even had more than the Americans, and we've worked with our friends on the panel as part of our approach to ensure that freedom of navigation is maintained in the Straits of Hormuz, and that actually there's stability there. And we see that as leaching into the whole region. And then if we go further east, we've got our traditional responsibilities and relationships with Nepal and Brunei. But for me, as a head of Navy, the piece that's very exciting at the moment is that we are investing in our military and in particularly our Navy. So I'm a new naval chief just over 6 months in. The Royal Navy will increase in size in tonnage terms between 2015 and 2025 by nearly 30%. 5 years ago, we didn't have any aircraft carriers. We now have 2, and in the next 5 years, both of them will be available to operate with 36 fast jets. 5 years ago, we didn't have a program to replace our anti-submarine warfare frigates. Today, we have 2 frigate programs, and both of those start to come in the next few years, and they include partners like Australia. Now, I think that what that demonstrates is a backdrop for the UK to build on its traditional place in this region, but to also do more to support our partners as part of ensuring that the rules-based international system is followed, but also to build on our collective security and prosperity.
You've got ambitions, you've got presence across the globe, but you're also facing a defence budget crisis. How does that fit into all of this?
Well, I'm not sure I would recognise a defence budget crisis. So I think the defence budget continues to rise. We have a government that has been very clear that it places defence as a priority. We have a government that has been explicit in saying that this year it will hold an ambition to hold a rigorous defence review, which aims to be what we call integrated. So not just to be about defence, but to be about all of our security partners and with our foreign policy lead and umbrella as to how we approach that. And so I think, again, I would be far more positive. I think as chiefs in the UK, we definitely welcome that approach. And I think the exciting thing for us is how prepared are we to lean into some of the changes and some of the challenges that we see. So some of the challenges are the ones that you've outlined about how we have to be out in the world and to stick to our principles about security and stability and a rules-based international system. Some of the other challenges are also opportunities. As a set of chiefs, we've acknowledged that our own backgrounds have tended to be a journey of jointery, so working far more closely as a naval officer with our land and air colleagues. The challenge for us moving forwards is that we see that we've got those three domains, but now they've got two further domains in space and cyber. And we have a technological revolution that's going on all around us, which means that we have to shift our armed forces as well as responding to the geopolitical challenges.
But doesn't there was a report based on a September review that the British armed forces faced a funding crisis that threatens to ground aircraft and restrict deployment of support vessels.
So this is the... I smile because there is a... This is almost the annual reporting of another financial crisis. The fundamentals, if we can step back and see what is happening with UK defence, UK defence is being invested in. The characterisation that I gave of the Royal Navy, that is a phenomenal recapitalisation of the Royal Navy. And I could have gone on to talk about a major piece of investment, which is the replacement of our nuclear deterrent. Now, I think what that report spoke to was what is not unusual, and I'm not proud that we have these moments, but it's almost the cash piece of looking at the budget over the next year. But I don't recognise the report that says that we're going to be grounding our aircraft, we're going to be stopping deploying our ships. These are budgets that are in the order of £40 billion. And within £40 billion, as somebody who has a budget of £7 billion, there are choices for all of us to help to balance those books. And I think we're at one of those points again where we might have to make some difficult choices, but I don't recognise the sort of sensationalist language that's being described about those choices.
But before I throw to the audience, I just wanted to ask you one other question about Britain's position as far as China is concerned. I mean, Australia, for example, if we talk about it from a political point of view, you know, it was very swift on how it approached and dealt with Huawei, for example. Britain has not been as forthcoming. Politically, past leaders have rolled out the red carpet with China and have described it as an important trading partner. But militarily, from your perspective, how do you view China? Do you see it as a threat?
So I think we have been very consistent. So our consistency has been shaped around a rules-based international system. And I'm very proud at the way that we have been able to respond in a much stronger way than in the last two or three years than we have done over the previous decade. And if I give the examples in the maritime space of working much more closely with our Japanese colleagues, our Australian colleagues, our French colleagues, our Canadian colleagues are, and American colleagues, and the nations in the Indo-Pacific, so that we stick to our principles. And that has been evidenced by the way that we have supported freedom of navigation in the South China Seas, the way that collectively we have all supported freedom of navigation through the Straits of Taiwan, the way that we have also responded to UN Security Council resolutions and our approach to North Korea. So the UK has been doing much more in the last 2 or 3 years than we have been doing over the previous decade. Now, I think that, to me, reflects a consistency that the UK has about those issues, whether it's in the South China Seas, or it's in the Gulf, or it's in the High North. And I think that's where we are aligned as a panel, and it's less about the language of describing China as a threat. It's more about sticking to our principles around security, a rules-based international system, and that we have the opportunity for shared prosperity if we use the high seas and the global commons as we know it in order to further all of our economies.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Raisina podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and for further updates, follow us on our social media and our website.